Well, you know what? I think we can go ahead and get started if you want. Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy Hatch, and I do apologize for the mix-up in the phone numbers, but I'm really, really glad that freeconferencecall.com did their thing and told everybody as they called in that the number had changed. So that was great, and thanks, Bill, for getting it up on the website quickly, too. Appreciate that. Anyway, this is an IELTS conversation, and it's presented by the IELNet, National Training and Technical Assistance Program of Independent Living Research Utilization, or ILRU, as you guys all know them, and it was organized and facilitated by April. So we're really happy you all could join us and are looking forward to some lively discussion today. I think we have a really good topic. We have about an hour and a half, so we'll start out with an introduction to our speakers, and then they'll each kind of discuss expanding skill capacity through engagement of consumers with mental illness. That's a new topic kind of for the IELTS world, and that's really, really important that we include this in the things that we do every day. So we're going to try and keep it as conversational as possible, but I know there are questions will come up kind of throughout the presentations. So what I'd like to do is I think Dee is going to speak first. As soon as she's finished, we can have a little short question and answer after her presentation, and then Kathy will do the second thing, and we'll do some more after hers, and then, you know, just sort of go from there. But a little bit of housekeeping kind of before we start. First of all, on the April website, which is www.april-rural.org, there are several print documents and links up there. So if you go to the April website, the first thing you're going to see on there is today's IELTS conversation, and you'll see several things. First is we are providing CART today, CART captioning services, and that can be accessed on that website too. You'll see that that highlighted on the invitation for today's call. And you can ask questions via the chat line if you like. And I see there's several folks on here on the chat line, so that's great. I'll be monitoring that. So if you have a question, you know, just send it to me or send it to everyone. That's fine, and I'll make sure it gets asked in the course of the conversation. I'd like to ask everybody to put their phones on mute. I think everybody pretty much has already. Since it's a bridge line, it's really sensitive to any kind of background noise or cell phones. Uh-oh, somebody's got a phone ringing. Cell phones and speaker phones. So *6 to mute your line, and if whoever's got that phone ringing in there could try to make that stop, we'd appreciate it. Also, want to remind phone. Yes. Hello.
Sorry.
Okay. Somebody caught the wrong line, I think. So once the Q&A starts, I'll try to moderate the discussion a little bit. But if we could all just be courteous as possible and try not to talk over each other, that would be great. And we'll kind of try to go one question at a time. So, I'd like to introduce our presenters today and welcome them. I'll begin by telling you a little bit about each one of them. First we have Dee Barnard, who is from the Executive Director at Access to Independence in Madison, Wisconsin. Is everybody hearing okay? I guess I should ask that before we start.
I'm getting some clicking feedback. I don't know where it's coming from. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's try that *6 again. Make sure anybody that comes on. You know what? I'll remind folks every once in a while through the call. And
okay,
Kathy, if you hear it and you're trying to speak, say something, okay?
Will do.
Alrighty, thanks. Anyway, so Dee has spent her entire career in the disability field, having worked in community mental health, educational, occupational therapy, rehab, and for independent living centers since 1988. While working in the IELTS field, she's held several positions from youth transition coordinator, program director, and assistant director, and since 2008 has been executive director of Access to Independence in Madison, Wisconsin. Dee's also an active member of the Wisconsin Coalition of Independent Living Centers, and her primary interest areas have been program development and implementation and staff development. And currently, Dee has been focusing her energy on diversification of funding and the development of fee-for-service programs that will enhance and provide stability within the IELTS Center. Kathy Noble Iverson is our other presenter, and she's been director of Independent Living Resources in La Crosse, Wisconsin, for about 20 years. She's been an active member of Wisconsin's State Independent Living Council and also the Wisconsin Coalition for Independent Living Centers. ILR has developed exceptional skills in blending the IL philosophy with mental health recovery to be a provider of a wide variety of mental health services. ILR currently supports a mental health drop-in center that serves over 450 people a year. They provide skills training, comprehensive community services, that is like Medicaid reimbursable services, provide wellness and recovery planning, mental health first, and peer specialist training. And she'll explain more about that as she speaks, I think. ILR has two contracts to provide follow-along services after crisis intervention and education about county mental health services and consumer control. So again, they're here today to talk about expanding SIL capacity through engagement of consumers with mental illness. And now I'd like to turn it over to Dee Barnard. Dee?
Thank you, Kathy. I'm going to just start off talking a little bit about some Wisconsin history in mental health services. So I just want people to know change doesn't happen quickly when you hear what I've got to say. In 1996, Governor Doyle from the Blue Ribbon Commission on Mental Health, and this body was charged with examining how Wisconsin's mental health services could be improved and recommend that Wisconsin services focus on a recovery process. So again, it was changing the look of mental health services. In 2008, through a Medicaid infrastructure grant, funding was made available to develop the peer specialist program as an employment initiative for individuals with psychiatric disabilities. ATI was contracted to work on this initiative and work closely with the Recovery Implementation Task Force Peer Specialist Advisory Committee. These committees were kind of asked to develop core competencies for peer specialists and looked at the training curriculums that would prepare individuals with knowledge and skills needed to move towards employment as a certified peer specialist. These committees also developed the code of conduct, sample job descriptions, and reviewed a variety of training curriculums that can be utilized, again, to prepare individuals for the Wisconsin Peer Specialist Certification Exam. In Wisconsin, the Department of Health Services Division of Mental Health and Substance Abuse chose to provide certification for these individuals rather than licensure. And I'm going to go off a little bit. Certification just indicates that they have met the training competencies and were able to pass a certification exam. It is not licensure. If your state is going into licensure, it's a much more complicated process. ATI did the work, hired statisticians and a variety of other individuals to work on the exam. It included people with lived experience with mental health, and it included people running county mental health programs, as well as other areas that would employ potential peer specialists. The exam was developed, and the first exam was held in January of 2010, and that was done in partnership with UW-Milwaukee, who actually holds the test and provides it on an internet base. It's a web-based test, and the test is basically proctored by the 8 independent living centers in Wisconsin. And the reason for that was that it would be easy access to people who wanted to take the exam, and it also allowed people to become familiar with independent living centers in Wisconsin. The exam is based on core competencies that cover 8 domains and objectives: self-knowledge and the role of peer specialists, ethics and boundaries, cultural awareness, advocacy and the ability to locate information, teamwork, service recipient choice and empowerment, crisis and safety, and recovery. Today in Wisconsin, we have over 300 certified peer specialists, with approximately about 85% of them are employed. Peer specialists tend to be employed in a variety of settings. They can be in an outpatient setting, veterans hospital, supported living arrangements, prisons and forensics, homeless shelters, tribal community health care, drop-in centers, community support programs, comprehensive community service programs, aging and disability resource centers, independent living centers, crisis stabilization and respite programs, long-term care programs, and we also have seen in Wisconsin where the Division of Rehabilitation Services will often contract for those services as well. Certified peer specialists engage and encourage peers towards recovery. The peer specialist provides a sense of belonging, supportive relationships, valued roles, and community. The goal is to promote recovery-focused wellness, independent living, and self-direction, which enhances the skills and ability of the peer to meet their chosen goals. Peer specialists work from a strength-based perspective and embody the belief that recovery is possible. Certified peer specialists use their unique set of recovery experience in combination with solid skill training to support peers who have experienced a psychiatric disability. Independent living centers have a long utilized peer mentors to assist individuals in gaining the knowledge and the skills they need to increase their independence, to enter employment, and to be active members of the community. Peer specialists also provide these along with hope to the individual with a psychiatric disability. Today, ILCs see many individuals with co-occurring disabilities and are working to increase their capacity to work with all types of disabilities. Ways to increase services and capacity. Find out what your state is doing to move to a recovery-based system. Get involved on committees and increase your agency's capacity to serve individuals with psychiatric disabilities. Developing a healthy organizational culture and mental health recovery is a crucial component in the success of a new or existing program. Some of the known successes are organizes or agencies often become better places to work. Programs show continued improved outcomes. Employee retention grows and there is a greater ownership in the workplace. Synergy is created and staff work more effectively. Consumers receive a higher quality of services and community collaboration and partnerships improve. I'm going to reference the employer toolkit that I believe Kathy has put up for you. On page 23, there's what's called an employer toolkit, and that was something that was designed primarily for counties to prepare to employ peer specialists within their organizations. But this tool can also be modified to kind of look at your independent living center and assess its readiness for recovery-based services. The assessment tool can be used to begin preparing to evaluate an existing program. It can look at overall agency readiness and your readiness to incorporate peer specialists as a staff member and the supervision of peer specialists. As you can tell, I've been very involved on a systemic level, and I do employ peer specialists as well. But Kathy's going to talk more about how her independent living center actually responded to the need for peer specialists through what her community was telling her. So that's all I'm going to say for now. So if you have questions, I did more of the systemic change.
Okay. Any questions from anybody? Some of what you talked about was pretty much Wisconsin oriented, but I think it's transferable to other states. So, hoping does anybody have any questions at this point?
Where is this tool that she was talking about? Because I saw an email reminding us about the call, but I'm not quite sure where the tool is.
Right. If you go to the April website, which is www.april-rural.org. Okay, in the very front of that, right at the top of the website is the information about today's call, and there should be a link in there of either a link or it's actually the document itself is up there.
What's actually listed there?
It's listed. Okay. So it's actually the document itself then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So whoever was asking about that. Any other questions for Dee at this point? No? Okay. Don't forget you have to take your phone off mute, and that's *6 again. It toggles on and off.
I'm going to go on mute.
Okay.
I tried it, and I disconnected myself. This is Kathy.
Oh.
I am truly technologically impaired.
Well, this is a heck of a day. We're having issues with the cart and with the phone number and with the phone. Maybe it knows it's my last time, so it's going to give me as many troubles as possible. I guess. Anyway, all right. Well, now we'll go ahead, and I think Kathy Noble Iverson is going to go ahead and speak now about some things from her side of the issue.
Right. Let me reiterate that what we're talking about, some of it's really specific to Wisconsin, but it a lot of the big picture things are things you can certainly start at your center at any time. I wanted to let you know, we do have 14 certified peer specialists on staff, and they do a lot of different things at our agency, and we're going to hire another one. We're going to hire an IL staff person in a couple weeks, and we hire folks who are living with a mental illness, who are in recovery, so that they can become a certified peer specialist sometime in the next year. We opened our doors in 1994, so we're a fairly newer center. But when we did, we were really committed to serving cross disability, and we thought we were doing a fine job serving people living with mental illness. And then in 2002, we were approached by a local county because they knew we did advocacy. They asked us if we would help them figure out how to get mental health consumers more involved in the system, because there was a movement in La Crosse County that really wanted to change the mental health system. And so we jumped on board and said, okay, we can do this. We'll help you get consumers involved. And we really did. I think at our high point, we probably had about 35 or 40 consumers involved showing up for meetings and systems change, work groups, and all sorts of things. And one of the things that we were just sort of hit over the head with, our involvement with this process had a huge impact on our organization. And it made us realize, number one, that we weren't doing a very good job serving people living with mental illness, and that we were ignoring a mental health system that really was many, many times doing more harm than good to people. That the traditional mental health system was taking care of people, was making decisions for the folks that they were serving, that people had absolutely no say in the types of services they got, and it really upset us. So we really even got into this more and decided, okay, we need to ask people what they want. We did a couple huge meetings in La Crosse, and it only invited people living with mental illness, nobody else. And they had to have had some experience in the service system, whether it would be private or public. And, you know, we got incredible response from them. And they had no problem telling us what they wanted to see in the system change. And they wanted and you're gonna really see the connection to IL here when I list this. I think it was like 6 things or 8 things that came out of this survey. It was that they wanted involvement in the change process. They wanted control input in the services they receive. They want to be integrated into their community. They wanted to experience hope and to have the people around them have hope for them, that they could have a good life despite their diagnosis. They wanted good, solid information about whatever they needed, whether it's housing, advocacy, Social Security, so they could make good, informed choices. They wanted employment, and they wanted alternatives to hospitalization. They just, this group in this community really felt that And data shows that we have one of the highest rates of hospitalization in the state of Wisconsin in this particular county. So this got us and the folks we were serving or supporting in the involvement to get even more involved. Right now we have a contract, I think you heard this, for a peer run drop-in center, and we have been asked to develop two more of those. We are a CCS, Comprehensive Community Services Provider, and that is basic skill training with a real tilt towards mental health, coping, understanding, you know, your triggers, developing a wellness plan, those sorts of things. But it is skill training. And we have a Consumer Affairs Coordinator, which is provides education, support, and advocacy for folks who receive CCS. And we have a follow-up crisis case manager who is also a certified peer specialist, and she has her master's degree, and she still feels that the whole mental health, the peer specialist certification added so much to what she is, how she's practicing now and what she learned in school. So we have three staff who are trained to train certified peer specialists. We have a WRAP facilitator, which is a wellness recovery action plan trainer, and two staff who are trained in mental health first aid. So like Dee said, none of this happens fast. Started this process 12 years ago by getting involved in an advocacy issue locally, and really have been building up to what we're doing now. But we've learned so much about how to make this happen that's why I wanted to share this with you folks. Because I think when you start talking about building capacity in your center, there's some real basic things that you have to do. And one is you have to really take a really good look at who you are as an agency. You have to look at the agency's culture, and you need to understand the difference between your culture and the activities that you do for when you respond to a consumer's request for services. And I'm going to give you some examples of that. So your agency culture, and I don't want anybody to take offense here, but I'm going to use examples of how a culture might not be a very healthy environment for someone who's living with a mental illness. Is that maybe most of your staff have a physical or a sensory disability, and no one on staff at least tells anybody that they have a mental illness or live with a diagnosis. Poor language is really used in your office. You would never use language that was offensive to someone with a physical disability, but the words crazy, insane, nuts are used all the time and sometimes in really offensive ways. There's always condemnation about the lack of self-help from someone who doesn't look ill but might have some behavioral issues or related to their diagnosis. And one that's in the newspapers all the time is this connection when a horrible act of violence happens in the community, that it's really connected to mental illness. And in a lot of centers, in a lot of businesses. I happened to walk into a business that we're a collaborator with a couple years ago when there was the horrific shooting on a base, a military base. And I heard when I walked in the door was some crazy bastard just killed, a whole bunch of people. And I got very sad and tried to talk to them a little bit about, you know, maybe he's mentally ill, but there was this definite connection that they made, whether it was, on purpose because he believed differently or that he was mentally ill and the result of that violence was because of his illness. I think we need to be careful how we talk about people who live with mental illness. There's also a real, and I hear this from consumers, from people we serve all the time, that people talk around them or talk to them as if they have an intellectual incapacity, that they're stupid, that they're developmentally delayed, versus simply having a mental health diagnosis. So that's an example of what the culture in your organization might be like. Then there's the example of taking a look at how you respond to requests for services from people when they come to you, when they call you, when they walk in the door. And this can take on a whole variety of issues, but I've heard from people who feel like they've walked into an independent living center and they've been not treated the same as if they had walked in and they were an amputee, or if they were blind or deaf, that they don't feel that they were treated with the same level of respect. So when you talk about a request for services, you know, are you referring people back to a system that's already failed them and they're coming to you because it has failed them, and you simply go, well, you need to go back to the county, to the mental health system, because we can't help you. Your social worker should keep, you should go back and help them, have them help you apply for SSI or help you deal with work-related Social Security, or that, you know, you talk about the fact that, you know, I'm really sorry you got hurt while you got raped while you were on a psychiatric unit. Maybe you need to go back to the hospital and file a report. You know, those are the kinds of things that happen to people living with, a mental health diagnosis every day. And unfortunately, lots of times that happens when they walk into an independent living center. So I think the first thing people really need to do is to take a look at how your organization talks about and deals with mental health internally, and then how you deal with it when a consumer walks in and wants services. And to me, the one of the best tools you can use, and you can tweak this tool, it's the tool that Dee talked about. It's the organizational self-assessment that's part of the, and there's other assessments out there. You might find something that's maybe more appropriate for your state that might deal a little more effectively with your own mental health system in your state. But I think it's really important that you take a look at yourself first, because you can't, if you're in denial about how you deal with people, there's no way you're going to make enough change in order to do a good job responding to people who need our services. The other thing that I would suggest is that once you've really taken a hard look at yourself, and you don't necessarily need an assessment tool to take a hard look at yourself. Our agency always does that through our strategic planning process. And so, somehow you need to really take a look, are we doing the best we can do? And our organization is constantly working to try to improve how we serve people, whether it's a person living with mental illness or another disability. So we are always sort of evaluating what we could do better. Once you've done a self-assessment, you really need to develop some sort of plan. And, a plan is in the eye of the beholder. You know, I don't care if it's something that, bullet points that you put up on a wall. As long as everybody in the organization understands what your plan is and what you're shooting for, what your outcome is. A couple of different times we published our plan to get better at something in our newsletter. That way people sort of hold us accountable, along with holding ourselves accountable. It's out there. And we really feel like you have to figure out what you need to change in your organization in order for it to be a really safe place for employees who want to identify themselves as a person living with a diagnosis, mental health diagnosis, or that so that a consumer gets dealt with as fairly and as high a quality of service as anybody else that comes to your center. So there's a whole list of things that you could identify, and I'll just identify a few that got us really on track when we decided we wanted to do a better job serving folks. And first thing was, we realized we knew so little about the mental health system in our state. We really thought we knew a lot, and we did not. We knew a little bit about local about some of the local mental health system, but we didn't know much about what was going on statewide. And, you know, one of the first things we got our hands on when we started this was the Blue Ribbon Commission report. And then we used the information and feedback we got from our consumer listening sessions that helped us really start to focus on the kinds of things that we could change internally so that the outcome was that a consumer felt that they had total control over their services, that they're treated with respect when they walk in the door of whatever organization is providing them services. You need to learn about mental health recovery philosophy and how that fits with the IL philosophy. There is along with the toolkit and the self-assessment on the April website, there is a called Mental Health 101, and it's a little thing we did, a little article that we did for ourselves so that all staff understood why we were taking a look at mental health recovery. It's called Mental Health Recovery 101 and how it sort of blends. And to us, it was like a perfect fit. Mental health recovery and IL philosophy, we just use a little different terminology. They are so compatible that when consumers do come to you and they're served well, they go, wow, why didn't I know about you people? How come, you know, where were you 10 years ago when I was hospitalized for the first time and people told me I was never going to be able to do anything ever again? You know, it's things like that that we hear from people all the time. You need to learn how to reduce stigma in your own center first, and then to help people, we train people how to tell their stories so that they can go out and they're starting to consider themselves stigma busters, and so they can go out and help people understand why certain terminology and other things, you know, hurt them, make them feel bad, and don't help the community understand what they have to offer. It's always in a real negative tilt. You also need to learn about trauma. There is more and more coming out about how so much of mental health issues are from the base of some trauma that someone has experienced or ongoing trauma. And, you know, trauma, again, one person can handle a trauma where the next person can't, and it causes some changes in their in how they respond to life in general. So I think it's really important. There's some really good information out there around trauma. And I don't know, Kathy, did we post anything about trauma on the website? You know,
I did not. I'm not. Okay. I have posted what you guys sent me, so if you have something else that you'd like to put up there, we can definitely put it up, and people can still access it after the call.
I think we'll find some stuff,
okay.
And do we need to send it to Billy?
You can either send it to Billy or you can send it to me. I'll take care of it. It's not a problem.
Okay, good. Yeah, what we realized and with feedback from some of our staff that sometimes we were re-traumatizing our own staff at work. And part of it was our fault as an agency, and the other was that the staff person didn't share with us that, for example, I'm a real touchy-feely hugger person, and when I talk to people, I like to connect with them physically. And we had somebody on staff who had been physically abused on a long-term basis, and that was a trigger for her. And I did not know that, and I could not figure out why there was this huge issue between us, and we finally figured that out. So, and we have, you have to talk about this kind of stuff real openly. It has to happen with everybody in your organization in the room, and the administration of your organization really has to buy into these changes. It can't happen in a little program over, you know, outside the finance office. You know, it has to be a system wide. So, and then you need to keep updating your plan. Your plan needs to be flexible you need to take a look, and when you think you've accomplished something, you really need to take a, you know, an in-depth look at, like, okay, have we done everything we can in this area? We've changed some training curriculum. We've changed not many, but a few policies and procedures that we felt maybe didn't have very good language, or that we might indirectly be discriminating against someone with a psychiatric disability. Next, you need, and Dee talked a little bit about this, you need to get involved in the mental health system so that your SIL staff really understand what's going on locally, statewide, and nationally. And I think if you're a center and you start to learn about this stuff, you should get really upset, because folks, the mental health system is light years behind other systems as far as providing up-to-date services, not having wait lists. I mean, here in La Crosse right now, if you have a child with a mental health issue, they can wait for 2 years to get in to see a psychiatrist. You know, what good is that for a family when they're in crisis and when the kid is in crisis? So I think there's lots of advocacy issues that as an organization that really should be part of everything we do every day. You need to develop and utilize maybe a certified peer specialist as an IL staff person, as your first staff person. You know, I don't know what you call them. Here we call our IL staff independent living specialists, and three of those staff were our first peer specialists. And there wasn't a certification process then, but we trained them. We got them trained from an organization in Arizona. And so I think you have that wonderful combination of skill set that an IL staff person has, and then you add the knowledge about the mental health issues, and you have this amazing employee who it changes how you deal with everybody, not just how you deal with folks living with mental illness. And we have certified peer specialists in middle management. They do IL. They run our drop-in center. We do skill training. There are trainers who go out in the community and train. And we have three certified peer specialists. We just secured a year ago a grant to provide technical assistance to other peer-run organizations statewide. And so it's really been a wonderful thing for us. It and Dee said this earlier, it changes an organization. I don't care if you're an independent living center or a mental health counseling center or, you know, a homeless center. Hiring people got the experience and have the training and are healthy and in recovery really, really will change your outcome, and it'll change your work environment. It'll be a better place to work. And that's all I have. Does anybody have any questions? Sorry, I'm feeling like this is going to be short and sweet.
I have one.
Yes.
My name is Dorothea Box. I'm from the Oakland and Macomb Center for Independent Living Disability Network,
okay,
is what we call ourselves now in Michigan. Did you develop an alliance with your local NAMI? National Alliance for Mental Illness?
No, we did not.
So we
have a relationship with them. A couple of our staff go to the meetings, but our local NAMI was all parents over the age of 70 or 75, and it's changed now. Now we have a very different relationship. You have to remember, this was 12 years ago, and it was, they wanted to keep their children in the church basement and have somebody take care of them because they were never going to ever be able to do anything. And so we've worked with them and lots of people in our community over the last 12 years to help them understand, you know, that we have a different philosophy. We do believe their children can be successful and have very fulfilling lives despite the fact that they have a mental illness. And that took some political maneuvering on our part to just be part of their organization and sit there and listen and then take opportunities to talk about, you know, the changes in philosophy and what was coming. So it took a long
time. Kathy, this, some of the NAMI affiliates here in Wisconsin, some of them are very active. Some of them actually provide peer specialist services through the comprehensive community support services and a variety of other things. I think it really depends on the culture of your local NAMI, too, about,
thank you. Well, our local NAMI now is very different than it was 12 years ago. So it is. They're one of our partners now. So,
our local NAMI provides classes. They call them Families in Action classes, but they've allowed us to attend their classes even though we're not, you know, parents of adults or children with mental illness. And everything that you've been talking about, they teach. If your local NAMI is offering classes, I highly recommend it.
And they trained our several of our staff at our drop-in center. They also offer great classes on how to be a facilitator, a group facilitator. You know, I think that's part of what people need to do is seek out, you know, resources and partners in the community to see what you have in common and what you can do for each other. Because one of the things that's paid off for us is the parents and the participants now in NAMI really know a lot about who we are and what we do, where, you know, 12 years ago, they did not.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time to develop that partnership, though, right, Kathy?
Oh, my goodness. 12 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the focus, I mean, of NAMI, you know, it was a parent-driven organization, and I think as more people became aware of recovery principles and recovery practices, they also had to look at things a little differently.
Because the curriculum that lady was, the person that just asked the question is talking about, is now a national curriculum.
It's called
different
something
things. Sometimes
else,
it's parent to parents, and sometimes it's other So, and we have a wonderful teacher here in La Crosse who's a mom who teaches that class once every 6 weeks. So, have changed a lot. So,
good.
Well, we seem to have lost our cart here again for a little bit. So, So just, you know, keep, if you've got more to talk about, we can do that. But I just want to let you go. She's getting reestablished
back
now.
Up.
So hopefully it'll be in a minute. What? She says she's getting reestablished. We said earlier when it happened, I said, we must be doomed today. And she said, oh, no, now the internet went down. So she said, but I'm getting reestablished, so hopefully we'll be okay in a minute. So anyway, so are there other questions for Kathy and Dee at this point?
Kathy, can you hear me?
Hey, I have a question.
I got
Hello?
Two people. Hang on. One person said, Kathy, can you hear me? If you want to go first, that'd be great. And then the second one who said they have a question, we'll get you next.
Okay.
Star 6 to come off
of
you.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Hi, this is Shelly. I'm from Oregon. And I just was wondering.
Hey, Shelly.
Hi there. In our experience, we have some real active mental health peer groups. And one thing we've noticed is, it's sort of difficult sometimes to partner because folks in the IL program are not always seen as peers. And that terminology sometimes creates some interesting barriers. I don't know if you've experienced anything around that, but I was also wondering if there has been, when you talked about having specialized training for mental health peers, how does that impact your organization as a whole, your center as a whole? Because my brain is just going to the place of saying, well, then would other groups, other types of disabilities say, well, we want to have somebody specially trained to work with us, and there are so many disability types. How would you do that? And, you know, maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure.
You want to go first? I see. I'll make a comment after.
I think the request, you know, for all the disabilities, I think personally, I think we already do that. We use interpreters. We use all sorts of things, but it's to accommodate somebody. And I really think that every disability we serve, that we've served probably in the last 8 years, if you ask, you'll find that majority of those folks also have a diagnosis of mental health or drug and or substance abuse. And we've decided that this just makes us a better center. We're not doing it so that we can just serve people living with mental illness. It's made us better at serving everybody. And so you learn how to do better interviewing. You learn how to help people with coping skills and how to develop a wellness plan. And those are things that it doesn't matter what your disability is, but that you can use as a tool in your job. So I personally don't feel like it's doing something special for one disability group. I think it's bringing on a better skill set to do a better job serving everybody. I would ask, how well do you think you do serving folks living with a mental illness?
Well, I work for the state council, so we're not providing direct services. But we have done some work with our with the peer support organizations, and at the state level, we have connections, and we're trying to improve the collaboration between the child program and the mental health program. And we have some centers that have fantastic some fantastic programs serving consumers that have
because we ran into the issue of not being accepted because we were an independent living center. First, we were being criticized. All the centers in Wisconsin were being criticized because the mental health system, some consumer groups, felt we weren't doing a good job serving people with mental illness. So as a group, you can see that there's several centers that are really stepping up and trying to do a better job. And then we got a little bit of resistance. And, you know, I'd say that, and Dee, you can comment on this. Do you think that's going by the wayside now, that we're sort of being accepted just because?
Well, I think, you know, the common image of an independent living center, unfortunately, is that you only serve people with physical disability or their sensory disabilities, even though we know we were serving people with, mental health disabilities as well. I think it depends on the comfort of your center as far as, you know, how well you serve that population. Again, I think the training to become a peer specialist, the core curriculums that are available really do give what I want to say value-added training to any IL staff. Because again, a lot of the things that you learn to become a peer specialist are all things that you transfer over to anybody else that you work with. And again, to talk about, you know, when I drill down on, you know, who are we serving, and we serve a lot of people obviously with multiple disabilities. When I drill down on that, 65% of the people that we serve also have a mental health disability. So again, and I think it's probably higher than that. People just aren't talking about it. So again, I think it's just a value-added training that just supports more of what you do.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear you saying is that you stepped up your quality in your center to serve people with mental health disabilities, and that just gave you more credibility with the mental health peer groups.
Absolutely.
And it
also,
that,
you know,
again,
this is Dean. I think Kathy also talked about, I think there was probably some discomfort among center staff as far as, you know, sharing that they did have a mental health disability. you know, how were they going to be perceived or treated as, you know, some of the things that she talked about earlier. And again, we have to make our environments open to everyone, you know, and feel comfortable to share that information. Again, you know, sometimes, you know, employing people with psychiatric disabilities, sometimes they work different schedules. Sometimes they have other accommodation issues that you need to address. And again, some of that learning about, you know, maybe somebody needs to come in later because of, you know, their medications, you know, they have a lag in the morning. So again, being open to some accommodations, which could be perceived, well, they just don't want to get up and get to work by 8:30. So again, that whole center attitude and thinking about people that you work with as well as the consumers that you serve, that's why it's got to be a whole center thing. The other comment I want to say, in Wisconsin, some of the other things that we did for all of the centers to make us stronger, we have what's called a mental health best practice committee. So we would look at self-assessment tools. We would look at what kind of trainings did we feel every center needed to have for their staff. And Kathy listed some of those, and we really worked hard to get that training across the whole state so that people could feel more comfortable and access services across the state.
Yeah, and we found some of this training was free. You know, we found out that at the state level, there was a person who's, you know, educated the world about trauma, and all of us were able to have that person come to our center and do a training. So I think it's, in fact, we've had her back 3 times, but I think it's really important that you, again, start to think about the kind of things that you think will help people be more open and accepting and to make your staff more comfortable.
This is Shirley with the Disability Resource Center in Charleston, South Carolina. What is the length of the training, and is there a recertification and process in addition to the initial training?
Yeah. In Wisconsin, we have 3 approved core curriculums that someone can participate in, and I'm not going to remember what they are. The National Association of Peer Specialists are commonly known as NAPS. DBSA, which is, I can't think of it, what the acronym means, but I can get that information out, and I'm trying to think of what the other one. Anyway, the state approves which curriculums we can use. We actually do a curriculum review as to what meets the standard for Wisconsin. So people go through the training. They have to take a test at the end of the training to see that, you know, they pass their curriculum training, and then they can take the certification exam, which is an online-based tool that exam that's proctored in the 8 centers. That's basically a 62-question test with multiple-choice answers. The requirement for recertification is that every 2 years, individuals must get at least 20 hours of continuing education. We actually have categories that they must get certain hours in, and then other ones can be related kinds of context to what a peer specialist might do. The other thing we're working on right now is really trying to integrate some of the substance use disorder things within it, because we know oftentimes a person with a psychiatric disability also has a substance use disorder. We're kind of working on how can we get that more entrenched into the core training of a peer specialist as well.
Yep, the core training for peer specialists is 6 days, 48 hours of training.
It depends on your curriculum.
Oh, okay. That's what ours is.
I mean, it's none of them are.
This is Kathy from Missouri. Can I ask a question about the training and also funding? I think someone mentioned a grant. I'm curious to know if you all received grant dollars to get people certified as peer specialists, and then if the service is Medicaid billable in your state.
I can answer that. Well, I want to talk about writing grants.
One at a time, guys.
Okay.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Okay. The state has lots of money out there to do training. But before that was available, we did our own training. I wrote a grant, and a $25,000 grant, and brought somebody up, and they spent 2 weeks at our center. Then the state started funding peer specialist training, and now they don't fund it at all, and it's sort of open market. And so we've continued as an agency, because I have three trainers, that we write grants, and what we're doing is training people in our service region so that there is an opportunity for people to work, and so that people will develop the opportunities. Employers will also develop the opportunities because they know there's people out there that are trained. So,
I think Dee had something else. Dee had some more to say about that, I think, real quick.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned what was called the Medicaid Infrastructure Grant that the state received in, I think, 2008. It was a five-year grant. And one of the initiatives under that grant was to really develop the peer specialist, certified peer specialist program as an employment initiative. And during that 5 years, there was a lot of training that was paid for through that Medicaid Infrastructure Grant to do peer specialist training. They did a lot of recovery training, trauma-informed care training, motivational interviewing. Oh, I'm trying to think. I mean, there was just a whole array over that 5 years to really start getting things in place for when we wanted to actually roll out the certification process. And yes,
are those kinds of trainings, Dee, are those trainings still available? Are those kinds of trainings still available somewhere?
Of them. But as far as the trainings available for becoming a peer specialist, the state has decided that was kind of free enterprise. So we have Kathy Noble Iverson's job does a particular curriculum called the NAPS curriculum. We have other people in the state that do, what is it, ROC, recovery, I forget the name of it, but I'll get that stuff for you. And they're trainers on that particular curriculum. And then there's the DBSA curriculum that people are eligible to take right now. But again, we also find for individuals who want to do that training, we've also worked with DVR, Vocational Rehabilitation, that we feel that that's a real great employment path. So they will pay for the training. They will support people if they need to be living in a hotel during that training and their meals, travel. And they will also support them in the fee to take the test. So, again, I think it's developing relationships all the way around. We did a lot of work with DVR as far as the potential for an employment outcome. You know, the state did a lot about the initiative of, you know, getting training out there and setting standards. So I think you really have to look at how your state's looking at doing that.
And then my second question about it being a Medicaid billable service, is it not?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. Well,
it depends on your state?
Yes. But that's another place for you to advocate. If it's not happening, like in Wisconsin, the only program that it's truly laid out is comprehensive community services, what we call. And that's kind of like an in-between community support program and like no services. It's kind of like a step up. But we do know that there are peer specialists paid for within a certain community support program. They may be working under a different title, you know, as far as I'm trying to think of what the title is under CSP. But again, it's an value-added skill that we're finding in Wisconsin that most community mental health programs want to hire certified peer specialists, even if it's not required, and they can bill under Medicaid. But we also had backlash, too, when we started rolling out the Certified Peer Specialist Program. People were like, well, they're not going to need a social worker, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. It was like, no, it's very finite what the role of a peer specialist is within a county system.
think is really important is the employer toolkit that was developed. Dee, I believe you were on that work group, weren't you? Or not?
Yeah.
It really helps you take a look at how to integrate that position into your position. Because there's some things happening, and this is going to happen anywhere, not just in Wisconsin, is that counties wrote into contracts, for example, in our area, that you had to have certified peer specialists providing this service. So they hired this Let's Use Community Support Program in Wisconsin, which is the intense Medicaid reimbursed service for folks who really need intense services. They were told in their contract that they had to have peer specialists on staff. So they went out, hired a peer specialist, and that person is treated more like a person who participates in CSP than they are like a staff person. And so it's really important that if you're going to bring folks on, that they're treated with, you know, they're treated like every other staff person. They're treated with respect, and that people understand their skill set and what they're supposed to be doing, not ask them to do things that are out of their realm, have a good job description so that they know what the expectations are, have a strong supervisor connected to that person so that probably a real seasoned supervisor so that they can get the support they need to be successful in their job. Because that's as important. It doesn't matter how skilled the person is coming into an environment. If that environment isn't healthy and isn't accepting of that position the way it was meant to be, it may not be a successful match.
And this is Dee again. In the back of that toolkit, there's a section called Attachment 4, and it's maximum allowable fees for outpatient mental health and substance abuse services and home and in the community for adults. And it lists a whole bunch of different things, and you might be able to find something comparative within your state. If not, it's a frame of reference. Maybe if you're going to be doing some advocacy with your state about, you know, do we just need to have it written into the rule, or do we need to, you know, submit something to CMS to get that approved for payment? But there are ways to do that.
Yep.
Again, the other part of the toolkit, especially if you're working within a county system or contracting with a county system, some of the things that we've also tried to address is oftentimes the certified peer specialist that you may hire to work in a county system may have also gotten services through that county system. And so we've really recommended that if that's the case, that their records are locked and nobody has access to them, because we know there's always curious people. And so there's a lot of different tips in here for, you know, rolling it out and working with your community and doing just some education about the benefit of certified peer specialists.
Okay, well, I have a question. Would you guys be okay with my putting your email addresses up on the website in case somebody wants to get in touch with you? I'm talking about Kathy and Dee. Is that all right with you? Okay.
Fine with me.
Okay,
yeah,
and also, okay, and some of these things that you're talking about, I'm not sure what's exactly up there right now, but if there were things about that list of the curriculums, for one thing, the different curriculums that you were talking about, or that kind of thing, we could put up those up there as well, and then people can access them if they want to.
Yeah, I'm writing my list of what I need to get you.
Okay. Okay, that's great. Great. Any other questions?
Yes. This is Vito.
Hang on. We got two people. The gentleman spoke first, I believe. Go ahead.
Thank you. Vito Lucido in St. Charles, Missouri. We're a center for independent living, and we're very familiar with peer support as we understand it here, and we have a very good center called Kreider Center that does a lot of work with mental health. And so we're trying to understand when you're referring to a peer, and then you also differentiate that from a social worker. Can you explain that a bit?
A peer, as far as what we're referring to as a certified peer specialist, I'll talk about that within the county system and in the county mental health system. They have, that is, in order to be a certified peer specialist, you must have a lived experience of a psychiatric disability. You must have gone through the training and passed the certification. The role of that peer specialist, depending on what type of program you work in, may change. We have peer specialists here, certified peer specialists here in Wisconsin that can do some case management. Some are doing skills training, helping people develop recovery action plans, helping them understand their psychiatric diagnosis. They're doing life skills training, some pre-employment kinds of things. So it's pretty varied. Now, I do know we also have some social workers within Wisconsin who also are people with lived experience who have also gotten trained under a certified peer specialist curriculum and passed the test. We're finding in those areas that they really believe that that's, again, an value training for them in working with the individuals that they're working with. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah, and this is Kathy. We have one of those social workers that's a certified peer specialist. In fact, she has her master's degree. And the work she does as a certified peer specialist is what the county is asking. They're not asking for a master's degree social worker. They're asking for someone with lived experience who can act as a peer to support people after they've been in crisis. So, you know, it's one of the things we have to work at here at our agency, because we have different folks doing different things that are certified, is that we just have to make sure that we're constantly clarifying with staff what role they're playing and what outcome we're getting paid to do for people.
Yeah, and it's driven by what program or service you're providing.
Mm-hmm. Somebody had another question a second ago. Was a lady out there. Go ahead.
My name is Alexa Mavroidis, and I'm from the Independent Center of Northern Virginia. I did want to say to the presenters that I don't know if anybody else is, but you guys are breaking up a little bit. So I don't know.
I can't hear anything. It's all broken up.
Yeah.
But the question that I had was, I heard you guys talking a little bit about action plans and wellness plans. Is that stuff the sort of stuff that's in the training for the certification?
Let me say something real quick before you answer that question, okay? If anybody is not on mute, make sure that you use *6 to be on mute if you're not speaking, because, like I said, cell phones and speakerphones sometimes make a problem. So *6, make sure you're on mute. Thanks. Okay, go ahead, Kath. Or D, I'm not sure.
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
It was about wellness action plans.
Guys, we're talking a lot about
wellness plans and action plans. And I think they touch on some of that, and D can reaffirm this. But in the training we do, we touch on some of that. And it's bigger concepts that we deal with, but you can get trained. We had a staff person that's gonna be, she's a WRAP plan, so it's a wellness and recovery action plan, and that's a real skill set. You have to get certified in that and are not supposed to be doing those plans with people. You can give them the information and they can develop their own, but if you're gonna develop a WRAP plan that person's going to use with them, you have to be certified to do that. There's a difference. You can educate a person about how to do it and give them feedback, but you can't sign off on the plan. It's Mary Ellen Copeland. I don't know how many of you are aware of her. She has a WRAP plan. Those are copyrighted, and so we have to be really careful about how we use her information.
And let me speak to that. There's several forms of what we would call recovery action plans. that, you know, people can start learning about their triggers or, you know, what's helpful to them when they start having symptomology. It's kind of taking control of their illness and kind of being mindful of, you know, what's going on and what do they want to have happen and you know, what helps them to relax or whatever the trigger might be. The Wellness and Recovery Action Plans that Kathy's referring to are, in fact, done by the Copeland Center, and you can look her up on the website. And it's a very, you need to be trained to do the Wellness Recovery Action Plans. Mary Ellen Copeland's very specific about that. We are fortunate in Wisconsin that I think right now we've got like 6 or 7 people who are able to facilitate those training. So that's really good. And how those work, at least in my shop, you know, we will hold wellness recovery action plan trainings, and we usually do them over 3 evenings, 2 hours a night with a core group of individuals. Might be 8 people, it might be up to 12 or 13. I don't think you really can do any more of that many people in that type of a session. And that has become a fee-for-service for us. DVR will pay for those kinds of things. Other types of service providers will pay to send somebody to really work on a really great wellness recovery action plan and really start talking about what are their triggers, what works to reduce their stressors or their symptomology, or what do they want to have happen when things aren't going so well? You know, do they want to go, you know, go to just someplace safe or, you know, what do they want to have happen? And it's always being revised with individuals because their situation changes, but it's a great tool, and it's kind of a, if you're really practicing recovery, that is one of the big tools that really instills hope and control over one's psychiatric disability. Would you agree with that, Kathy?
Yes.
Sounds like a good thing to have. So, any other questions? No? It's about 4:15, so we are coming up on the half hour that will be where we'll be finished. If any, I'll just ask one more time. Any other questions from anybody? Anything you'd like to ask these ladies? No? Okay, well, I think we'll go ahead and close it up, and I want to thank you all for being here today and for being patient with us. So this has been a little tough one. Thanks to our CART folks and our friends at Skill in Kansas who are recording the call. We appreciate that. Just so everyone knows, the recording of this will be up on the April website in just a very couple of days or something like that, and also a transcript from the CART. It's going to be a little bit sketchy, but the audio should catch everything. And I'd like to say thank you so much to our presenters, Kathy Noble-Iverson and Dee Barnard. You guys were great. You've got lots of information, and I hopefully think that, folks out there learned a lot today. Okay. Did somebody have a question?
Yeah,
did somebody ask a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can.
This is Barb from Red Rock Center in St. George, Utah.
Okay.
And I know you talk a lot about certification, but is that state by state or county by county? I understand that the Wellness Recovery Action Plan, that you have to get certified, but just to have the peer support, I don't know if there's any regulations in our state that would require that.
And it is different by state. There are several states who have certification for peer specialists so that they can bill Medicaid. But like Kathy started before that even existed, you know, the certification. So, again, I think it's by state by state.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't catch you quick enough there. So is there anybody else who's got a question? You have to use *6 to come off mute, so maybe that was the problem. Anything else? Okay. All right, well, so anyway, I'd like to invite you to visit the April website, where you'll find the documents that were discussed today. A few of them are up there already, and a few we will be adding over the next day or so. So we'll make sure that those are there, and that website is www.april, like the month, dash rural, R-U-R-A-L, .org. And just look for Aisle Conversations, and today's will be archived on there. So look over on the left-hand side for Trainings and Aisle Conversations, and you'll find it. If you have questions about today's discussion, you can reach me at Kat Hatch, that's K-A-T-H-A-T-C-H, at charter.net. And even though I'm going to be gone in a few days, I'll still answer questions, so don't hesitate. You could also reach Billy at the April office. But thank you so much for all being here today. This IL conversation is presented by the ILNet, which is operated by an independent living research utilization program at TIRR Memorial Herman in participation and partnership with Nickel and April. Support for the presentation was provided by the U.S. Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration. No official endorsement of the Department of Education should be inferred. So again, thanks everybody, and take care. Bye-bye.